This is the BBC.
Order, order.
Hello, this is Mark Darcy and thanks for downloading the Today in Parliament podcast for Friday the 20th of October. In this edition, MPs back a bill to clamp down on attacks on members of the emergency services.
It's incomprehensible that people should attack our national heroes like this.
Are calls for tighter controls on ministers' powers to implement Brexit simply asserting the rights of Parliament, or are they
an anti-Brexit bazooka for those who want to thwart the will of the British people?
And memories of the first Indian MP who died 100 years ago.
Enormous beard, very strong, powerful eyes, those round spectacles.
But first tonight, MPs have given strong support to a move to impose tougher sentences on people who attack members of the emergency services. A private members' bill from the Labour MP Chris Bryant was approved without a vote or any opposition from any quarter. He said such attacks were an increasing problem.
An assault on anyone is wrong, but an assault on an emergency worker, whether that's a police constable, a paramedic, an ambulance driver, an accident and emergency doctor or nurse, a fire officer, a prison officer, someone working in search and rescue, or on a lifeboat, an attack on any one of these people is an attack on us all. And when we are all attacked, we all stand firm together.
Emergency workers put their lives on the line to help others, he said.
We know that here in Parliament, where PC Keith Palmer was murdered earlier this year. We owe him a phenomenal debt of gratitude. London knows it. A brave British Transport police officer was stabbed when he faced the London Bridge attackers with nothing but a baton earlier this year. That same day, a Met officer was also stabbed when he came to defend the public despite being off duty. The whole country knows it too, as we have seen horrific instances week after week of emergency staff who have been stabbed, strangled, bitten, repeatedly punched, kicked when down on the ground, threatened with knives and with acid. It's incomprehensible that people should attack our national heroes like this.
Mr. Bryant, who topped the annual Commons ballot for the right to bring in a bill, told MPs he'd consulted his constituents and they'd overwhelmingly favoured this proposal. Attacking emergency workers was, of course, already a crime, he said, but the sentencing in the courts was often too lenient, so he wanted to make it an aggravated offence. He was supported by the Conservative former Cabinet Minister Stephen Crabb.
There's a real sense of anger and frustration, not just amongst police officers, but other emergency workers as well, when they see people walking out of court with effectively a slap on the wrist.
Labour's Holly Lynch agreed.
What thoroughly depresses 999 and NHS workers is that sentences handed down to offenders for assaulting them often fail to reflect the seriousness of the crime or, more crucially, serve as a deterrent. Many describe feeling like they had suffered an injustice twice, first at the hands of the offender and then again in court when sentences were unduly lenient.
Plaid Cymru's Westminster leader, Liz Saville-Roberts, told Mr Bryant the threat of tougher sentencing was particularly important in rural areas.
With a chronic reduction, particularly in police numbers, I hope this legislation will offer greater protection for officers in rural areas who are often responding to calls with insufficient backup and bad communications.
The Honourable Lady is absolutely right, and I can only praise her for being here today when she could have been at Plaid Cymru party conference already.
The Conservative Kimi Badenoch said police officers in her constituency felt besieged. 30 officers in Essex were assaulted every week.
But the real figure is far higher because many cases go unreported. Police officers in my constituency tell me that they are scared and don't feel the public understand or even care. This bill sends a message that we do.
One section of the bill would require people who spit at emergency workers to give a blood sample to be tested for communicable disease. Mr Bryant gave an example of the problems under current law.
A police officer who was spat at with the saliva entering his eye and his mouth. The assailant refused to give a sample, and the police officer had a false positive test for hepatitis B, which created enormous anxiety. His wife and his children had to be tested as well, and I just don't think that that's appropriate. I hope that this will help change that situation.
A number of MPs queried the definition of emergency workers in the bill. This was the Conservative barrister Victoria Atkins.
Does the honourable member consider that Clause 3 also includes jailers, people who look after defendants in court, waiting for trials and so on? Because it seems to me if it doesn't, perhaps some thought may wish to be given to that. Sometimes the cells at court can be very volatile places and the people working in that environment can themselves be at risk.
For Labour, the Shadow Policing Minister, Louise Hague, said the police were now being asked to attend to vulnerable people when they were not the appropriate agency to do so. On top of that, she said the force had lost 20,000 police officers and 30,000 non-uniformed staff. Morale was at rock bottom.
The only way to fix these issues is to resource the police and all our public services properly. We can never truly protect them unless they have the capacity and the support to deal with the many and varied situations their job throws at them.
On behalf of the government, the bill was also supported by the Justice Minister, Sam Ghima.
As the son of a nurse, a midwife, I know the commitment and hard work that many people who work in the public sector bring to their efforts every day.
And he particularly welcomed the section of the bill dealing with cases where emergency staff were spat on by people claiming to have infectious diseases.
It is simply not fair that the onus is currently on the emergency worker to have their own blood tested and to then potentially undergo a series of further tests to help medical practitioners assess whether they will develop these diseases. We therefore support the creation of a specific power for police officers to request blood and saliva samples from offenders in these cases.
No one spoke against the bill, and it was given initial approval by MPs without a vote. It now goes forward for detailed scrutiny. Now, it's still missing from the parliamentary agenda, but MPs have been promised 8 full days to scrutinise the EU withdrawal bill, what used to be called the Great Repeal Bill. But once again, the bill didn't feature when the Commons agenda for next week was announced yesterday by the Leader of the House, Andrea Leadsom, to the bemusement of her Labour shadow, Valerie Vaz.
When will the EU withdrawal bill come before the House for its committee stage of the whole House? I read on an email yesterday, Mr Speaker, that it's after the November recess. Is that correct? Should we not be discussing it here? Could the Leader of the House please tell us what's happening?
Andrea Leadsom retorted that the government was studying the large number of amendments and new clauses proposed to the bill by opposition parties and by cross-party groups of MPs.
There is nothing odd at all about a pause between second reading and committee of the whole House.
The SNP's Pete Wishart, though, offered an alternative explanation.
It's not all these amendments she talks about. It's because the fractious Conservative Party cannot agree a solid line on all this, and they're just terrified of any possible defeats. That's why we're not seeing it. And they're talk now that we might not even see the repeal bill much before Christmas. We have to see it soon.
The bill is a mission-critical piece of Brexit legislation designed to allow ministers to reshape 40 years of European law so that it works after Britain leaves. But critics fear the powers it gives to the government are far too sweeping. The speculation at Westminster is that the committee stage scrutiny won't now start until after the Commons' brief half-term recess next month. As we reported last week, the big issue is how much scrutiny is given when ministers exercise those extra powers. A backbench group, including big Conservative names like the former Attorney General Dominic Grieve, have proposed amendments to beef up MPs' ability to scrutinise the changes known as delegated legislation or statutory instruments, and that might mean some kind of committee to sift through them and see which need more debate. When the Brexit Minister Steve Baker appeared before the Commons Procedure Committee to discuss the bill earlier this week, the possible effects of those amendments were clearly on his mind.
But obviously the imperative is to deliver the statute book, and I think that part of the answer to your question is bound up in the condition of the bill after it has passed through both houses.
In other words, the government didn't want to be landed with a scrutiny mechanism so cumbersome that vital Brexit preparations weren't completed in time. And as Mr Baker continued, it was obvious that the government's fragile Commons position and its complete lack of a majority in the Lords was weighing on ministers' minds.
But some other matters of fact, the parliamentary arithmetic and the amendments switch are down, and therefore it is incumbent on us to think extremely carefully about the consequences of any amendments. And so when we look to a sifting committee, clearly Parliament has expressed a strong view, and we've listened very carefully to parliamentarians in what they've said and what has been proposed. But we are very mindful of the imperative to deliver a functioning statute book on time.
A Conservative on the Procedure Committee, Rahul Jawadina, tried to pin down his anxieties.
We've already seen members of the other place voting against Brexit legislation. Are you worried that a sifting committee, whether joint with the Lords or one in each House, would become an anti-Brexit bazooka for those who want to thwart the will of the British people?
Well, Mr. Jawadina, I think you make your own point with great eloquence, if I may say so. I don't really want to be on that territory. We must respect both houses, and both houses will have their own concerns, which we will need to listen to very carefully.
Both Steve Baker and Andrea Leadsom did their best to allay fears about the powers the EU withdrawal bill would give ministers. Mr. Baker disagreed with the House of Lords committee, which had warned it would effectively give ministers the power to impose taxes.
There are certain powers to allow us to continue to collect monies which the EU would require us to collect during the last days of our membership and then to pay those forward. But the powers on taxation are tightly circumscribed in the bill as it stands.
And Andrea Leadsom said the government was itself looking for ways to improve the way Parliament process secondary legislation.
We are trying to improve and upgrade the management of secondary legislation, including appointing a minister responsible for secondary legislation in each department and a senior civil servant whose job will be to oversee that, so that we can make sure that Parliament gets better notification of the volume and type of legislation that's coming forward.
When the SNP's shadow leader of the Commons, Pete Wishart, came before the committee, he was critical of the way MPs process the steady stream of secondary legislation that passes through the Commons every week. He sat on plenty of the committees which deal with it, and he wasn't impressed.
I wouldn't be alone in saying that there was a particularly frustrating experience. You would turn up for one of these meetings to observe various members and many disinterested states reviewing their mail, attending to other things, things that were obviously so much more important. I think most of these committees I attended possibly lasted 20 minutes out of the allocated 90 minutes without anybody making any significant contribution.
A better structure was needed, he said, to deal with important Brexit issues that would have to be handled by this process. So would all that mean more work for MPs? The committee chair, the Conservative Charles Walker, put that point to Andrea Leadsom.
As you know, Mr. Walker, we've committed to 8 full days on the floor of the House for committee stage of the EU withdrawal bill, with 8 protected hours on each of those days. Now, that clearly looks as if we may well sit late on those days if there are urgent questions or statements and so on, plus the normal departmental questions. So it is likely that due to the demands of Parliament, that there may be late sitting days, but obviously there is always a balance between not wanting to overload the system but have the proper level of scrutiny to make sure that we make this legislation as good as it possibly can be.
Andrea Leadsom. Does the NHS have enough staff in the right specialisms to treat cancer patients in England? This week, the all-party parliamentary group on cancer held a hearing with top health service managers and the cancer minister to find out how the 5-year cancer strategy for England is unfolding. Chairing the hearing, the Conservative MP John Barron wondered if there was too much focus on what he called process targets, waiting times for the first appointment, for example, rather than on outcomes like survival rates.
The inconvenient truth is that despite both governments, both parties, because we're non-party political here, this is an all-party group spanning the political divide, having instigated a series of process targets with regards to the NHS, some would say even bombarded the NHS with process targets, and what I mean by that is 2 weeks, 4 weeks, the 62 days, and so forth. Despite that, the NHS, we have not yet caught up, and there's no sign that we're even beginning to catch up with international averages when it comes to survival rates.
But one of the witnesses, Sir Harpal Kumar, who chairs the National Cancer Advisory Group, said there were reasons policymakers didn't rely more on survival rate figures.
1-year survival is an important metric, and it's very clear where CCGs are not matching up to the national or regional average. So I don't think it's being sidelined at all. And I think everyone recognises the importance of outcomes as the primary set of performance indicators. The reason I think that the other metrics are important is there's quite a lag to being able to get to the 1-year survival data. Often it can be up to 2 years after the period in question. And it's really important that everyone involved in delivering the transformation that we're talking about has a sense of how they're doing along that journey.
Another key concern was complaints that the money provided to underpin the cancer strategy wasn't reaching the front line. Witnesses denied that money was simply being sat on, and the Health Minister, Steve Brine, underlined his personal commitment to ensure the funding.
We are making a significant investment in cancer services. Everybody around this table knows what a priority is for me. It is absolutely a priority for NHS England and for the Secretary of State. So, you know, the £200 million investment in cancer services over the next 2 years is significant. And then, of course, the extra £130 that's been very well spent through the radiotherapy. But I would give it a bigger context. So I would say that NHS spend on the service, so the £10 billion extra real terms increase that we're giving it, and the public health spend, I mean, there's some £16 billion that we'll spend through the ring-fence public health grant. That is all, for me, that's all part of the cancer pound.
The all-party group moved on to questions about staffing, the training of enough specialists and consultants and specialist nurses, and then making sure they stay in post. Jo Lenehan, Director of Strategy for Health Education England.
We lose a lot of people during the training course, and in some areas, as many as a third don't actually go and work for the NHS, they go somewhere else. And then when they get in the hospital, that then becomes a leaky bucket because they leave from there. So we need to get a grip on both the leaky supply line and the leaky bucket. Understand people's lives and what is a healthy work-life sustainable balance is key to that.
She said some staffing issues had to wait on decisions about how cancer services were to be structured, how much might be based in clinics as opposed to GP practices, for example. But Sir Harpal Kumar of the National Cancer Advisory Group thought more could have been done.
Whilst lots of good stuff has happened, this would be the single area that we would call out and say there has not been enough urgency. I think it now is being addressed with some urgency, but it's taken us quite a while to get that level of urgency underway, shall we say. It was patently obvious 2.5 years ago that there were certain things we could have got on with then, and we haven't really got on with them, with a single exception of non-medical endoscopy, where some action has been taken. But the gap was so wide that we could have got on with some things 2.5 years ago when we still wouldn't have met the deficit.
The stature of the witnesses and the size of the audience crowding the public gallery underline just how influential the all-party group on cancer is and how much weight their verdict on the progress of the cancer strategy will carry. The Minister, Steve Brine.
These inquiries are really important. I remember doing them as backbenchers, actually, on the subject of breast cancer. The cancer community is just incredible. It's so passionate, it's so informed, and that's why all-party inquiries are so important, because they can bring ministers, they can bring cancer directors round the table, and then they ask really, really good searching questions, and they put us to the sword a bit, and that's exactly right, because we're spending hundreds of millions of pounds of public money here, and ultimately, people's lives depend on us getting this right, and we are determined to do so.
So what did the inquiry members make of the evidence they'd heard? The Labour MP Thangam Debonair remained concerned about staffing issues.
It was very interesting that Harpal Kumar said really specifically in relation to workforce, and I quote, "I don't think enough money is being spent on workforce." No, those are his exact words. I'm really concerned about the planning and the funding for workforce.
And the chair, John Barron, said he intended to keep up the pressure.
I'm reassured that the top table of the NHS, NHS England, the government, realise that there's real pressures on the NHS, realise that there's real frustration from the front line of the NHS as what appears to them to be lack of progress with regards to the implementation of the 5-year cancer strategy. We're halfway through and there's a lot of questions about how many of these recommendations, 96 recommendations in total, are going to be actually met. We've put these issues, these concerns, to the top table. We've been reassured that they realise the importance of them. We've heard some action plans. The message we're going to get across now is that we now need to see action. Action that those at the front line understand and see. It needs collaboration across the NHS, but I have been reassured that good plans are in train.
John Barron. Back to today in the Commons now, and MPs have given an unopposed second reading to a bill from the Conservative Kevin Holinrake to guarantee bereavement leave to parents who lose a child under the age of 18. He said the bill would fulfil a Conservative manifesto promise from the last election.
This leave will be protected, and a person should not suffer any form of detriment in the event they find themselves in the position to have to take the leave. Crucially, this bill will give an important choice to parents, allowing them to make a decision on what is best for their needs, where they might otherwise be reliant upon the goodwill of their employer.
He said most employers were sympathetic, but there were plenty of examples where bereaved parents had lost out or even been sacked for taking time off. An example came from the Conservative Will Quince, who, with his wife, has lost a child.
Somebody sent me an email to say that they were told they had to take a day's holiday to attend their child's funeral. It is totally unacceptable.
Another MP who's lost a child, the Conservative Antoinette Sandbach, said that if grief was dealt with appropriately and early on, it would have a great benefit in the long term.
My doctor wanted to prescribe me antidepressants. And as I said to him, I haven't lost, you know, I'm not depressed. I've lost a child, which is something completely different in terms of the grief.
Labour's Sharon Hodgson said she'd lost a child 19 years ago. She'd taken time off work without pay to grieve, but her husband had returned to work.
He could have took time off with pay, but he couldn't wait to get back to work. And that did cause problems. I still haven't quite forgiven him for that because I really needed him. But, you know, he chose and needed in his way to cope to go back to work. So it is right that this isn't enforced upon people, obviously, but I think he would have chose to have took that time later if that option had been available.
The Business Minister, Margot James, condemned cold and callous treatment of bereaved parents by their employers. The bill was sent forward for more detailed consideration without opposition. Finally tonight, this week marks the centenary of the death of the first Indian MP. Dadabhai Naroji took his seat in 1892 as the Liberal MP for the London seat of Finsbury, which he held for just 3 years. He's probably better remembered in India than he is in Britain, though his successor as local MP, Emily Thornbury, told me his memory is preserved there.
We've got a street named after him, we've got a doctor's surgery named after him. I was honoured to be there to unveil the blue plaque at the street where we've named after him. I mean, basically, he was an Indian politician who came over to the UK. He stood in the, at the time, staunchly conservative ward of Holborn. He was supported by Florence Nightingale, a number of people in favour of suffrage.
At a reception to mark the centenary, the Labour peer Lord Parakh explained why Dadabhai Naroji is remembered.
His impact in both countries has been enormous. In Britain, for example, he fought for the Irish Home Rule, votes for women, pension for the elderly, and lo and behold, abolition of the House of Lords. In India, he was a founding father of the Indian National Congress, fought for India's independence, and he also made sure that the Congress did not become a Hindu party. And he made sure that the Congress did not get involved in social reforms, because that would mean that they'll be specific to communities, Hindus, Muslims and others. He said Congress was simply concerned with national affairs, which is political matters, not social or cultural.
Yeah, as this reception unfolds around us, there are some pictures up on the wall. Is this him at the end here?
Yes. Enormous beard, very strong, powerful eyes, those round spectacles, and average height about 5'7", 5'8". That's what Dadabhai was. And his face is very famous in India because he was often known as the grand old man of India. Also, when Gandhi came to London as a student, he was fascinated by Dadabhai. So he attended every public meeting that Dadabhai Naroji addressed. This was true of many Indians who, irrespective of whether they agreed or disagreed with him. And his influence at the personal level through individuals was very great, especially through Gandhi.
And how was he seen by his fellow parliamentarians at the time? Was he seen as a bit of a novelty, or was he just...
Indeed, he was. Lord Salisbury, when he was selected by the Liberal Party, Lord Salisbury said, this country was not yet ready to elect a black man. Now, the use of the word black man irritated lots and lots of people in this country, in India. It turned to Dadabhai's advantage, and he won. And he won, lo and behold, by a majority of 3, which on the recount turned out to be 5.
Lord Parakh. And that's all from us. I'm Mark Darcy. The editor was Chris Bond. And that was the Today in Parliament podcast. Thanks for listening.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.